The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome.
I'm Anthony McCarthy. It's Monday.
It's Monday.
Great to be here.
Which means we're together again. We have a really interesting couple hours ahead of us.
Great 2 hours.
Over the weekend, I met Javier Cecilia, who is leading this Mexican-U.S. caravan for peace and justice and dignity to end the drug wars on both sides of our borders, a man who lost his son to the drug wars in Mexico. We'll hear parts of the interview today. But we are joined here by a real interesting group of people from Mexico, from the United States, people who have served time in prison and are fighting for justice, people who have served time as police officers and are now fighting for justice, people who have been part of the caravan, to talk about, is it time to end the war on drugs, and what does that mean? So we hit that from both sides of the border, and then Anthony and I take a look at the new OSI conversations on race taking place, and this is with Rachel Gotzel and Sean Dove, and it's about racial anxiety and the subtleness of racism in America and where it comes from and how to deal with it.
A great series they've been doing at OSI. I'm looking forward to the conversation in the second hour.
The second hour.
Of the Mark Steiner Show.
And Anthony's supporting his new glasses.
I look sharp.
You do. We're going to take a very brief break, check on the roads here in Baltimore. Those of you listening elsewhere, just put up with Baltimore traffic. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we both welcome you. Remind you on our way into this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MECU, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MECU invests in you. Remember, it's not just a bank, it's a credit union. It belongs to you. MECU.com. For more information, go to steinershow.org and click on their banner or go to www.mecu.com. There is a caravan that made its way from Mexico through the United States, the Mexican-U.S. caravan for peace with justice and dignity, to stop the drug wars. We'll learn more about what's going on in Mexico, where 40,000 people have been killed, hundreds of thousands of people displaced and missing. And the horrendous toll it's taken on the Mexican people. We know, living in the United States of America, we know where this show is broadcast from, living in Baltimore City, the numbers of people that have been affected by the drug trade, by being put in prison, by being murdered, having families completely displaced internally and externally, and what's happening to ourselves here in the city. We know that. We feel it. We see it. So what do we do about it? Javier Cecilia, who is one of Mexico's great poets, tantamount to a poet laureate in Mexico, lost his son to that drug war. And when he did, he decided that he had to do more and spoke out and said it's time to stop writing poetry and to end this war on drugs. And his son was murdered as an innocent in Cuernavaca, a city in southern Mexico. And it made him stand up and created this movement in Mexico and across the border. And we met with Jorge Celia yesterday. In a minute, we'll play one of the clips from that. We are joined here, by the way, in studio by Clayton Kahn, who is a local journalist who's participated in the caravan, has done some amazing photographic work that we have on our websites you can link to, and welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
A friend of ours, Pastor Billy Stanfield, founder of the New Vision Youth Project and Ministry, who served a lot of time in federal prison as a part of this drug trade, speaks not just from that experience, but also has the analysis to go with it. Good to have you in the studio with us, Billy.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Always good to see you. Retired Major Neil Franklin, who served with both the state and city police as executive director of LEAP. LEAP is the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And Neil, good to have you back on the show, but in studio live.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Laura Carlson is with us. She is director of Latin American Rights and Security, America's program at the Center for International Policy. And Laura, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Mark.
And we are also joined by Jorge Gonzalez de Leon, who is with the caravan. And when you hear the clips, he is the man who translated Javier's words. And Jorge, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for being with us, Jorge.
Well, we are here in Washington, as you know.
exposing and making visible the problem about the war, the drug war and its consequences, mainly.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. And before they're getting the clips ready so we can hear some of the words of Javier de Silva, but let's just jump into it. And let me just ask you, Jorge, to describe for us this caravan, who started it, and why you're part of it.
Oh, yes. Well, maybe I know Javier many years ago. I'm also a poet. We have been friends for many years. And I happen to be his murdered son, godfather. He was my godson, and, well, I'm here supporting this because I believe in what you're doing and because it just isn't fair that so many innocent people are getting killed.
And I'm going to do our guests who are here, from each perspective here, just lay some facts out. And Anthony, please leap in at every moment you can, because you're so passionate about this issue as well. But let me get a sense, you know, that, like Neil Franklin. You served in the police force for a long time,
Yeah, 33 years.
33 years. But now you've been passionate about coming into this thing about ending the prohibition of drugs.
Yeah.
Trying to find somebody new. Talk to our listeners about what it meant for you as a police officer to come to a new place when it comes to what's happening with the war on drugs in America and how you came to it.
Well, the first thing I want to say quickly is that it wasn't an easy journey. Hmm. It wasn't something that happened overnight or, you know, over a week or a month. Obviously, grew up in Baltimore City. I policed in Maryland and I policed in Baltimore City. And wonderful Mayor Kurt Schmoke back in the 80s made a suggestion of having a conversation about how we were using our drug policies and what they were about. And he realized that it was a serious health issue. We need to address it from that. But to have a conversation.
And he was pilloried for it.
Oh, yeah.
Across the country.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He was so far ahead of his time. He's just brilliant. And that gave me my first insight. I was a lieutenant with the Maryland State Police at that time, and I served on his needle exchange program board. But that wasn't enough to get me moving. It got me thinking about this issue critically. But it wasn't until 2000, after I retired from the Maryland State Police, and I started working for Baltimore as a commander of training, a good friend of mine who was a narcotics agent with the Maryland State Police, his name was Ed Totley. Okay. I'm sure some of the listeners remember that he was working with the FBI on a task force down in Washington, D.C., buying cocaine from a mid-level drug dealer. He had brought cocaine from this guy before. He thought he had a relationship with the guy. But it goes to show you it's really all about money, because on October 30th, this guy took Ed's life. He took both the money and the drugs during this buy. He didn't know Ed was a police officer. But when he came back supposedly to the vehicle with the drugs, he shot Ed at point-blank range in the head and killed him. Ed had three kids. His mother and father are here in Baltimore. And that was an awakening for me. However, I still didn't make the transition at that time. As a matter of fact, initially I was going to go out there and push harder and lock up more drug users and more drug pushers. But then as time went by, we had Kayvon Gavin killed in Baltimore here. We had Michael Cowdery on Harford Road killed by a drug dealer. And then we had the Dawson family.
Right.
Family of seven. The home set on fire by one drug dealer who was mad at the mother because she was working with the police, as a good citizen should, as we tell our citizens to do. And then it made me realize that I had to start speaking out on this from a position of violence. And that was my only issue, that the drug war was not working because of the violence that these policies created in our cities and in Mexico. But then as I started doing research and I started speaking out, and I stumbled across the 10-year-old organization now, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and I met other police officers and judges and criminal prosecutors and corrections officials and wardens and federal agents who have also made the transition. It's an international organization. And then Michelle Alexander's book came out, The New Jim Crow, about mass incarceration. I started learning what we had done to our communities and the people within our communities over the past four decades, blacks, my relatives, and the relatives of your listeners. And the money spent, $1.3 trillion over the past four decades, For what? We have more drug use and abuse in our communities than ever before. We can't stop it from coming into our communities. The violence is off the charts. Prisons are bursting at the seams. And the list is long. The corruption that we have within our ranks in the police. These policies have ruined policing. Have ruined policing. The racial profiling that it sits upon. I mean, here's a profession that I love. And it has driven a wedge in between police and our citizens. It's literally us versus them, and that needs to change. But that's just a handful of the problems that have come from this policy.
Neil Franklin, I'd like to ask Laura Carlson to come in. The sense of what this means for you, and I appreciate everything you just said, Neil, and that you, the power and emotion which, that you feel about this, and that's what it needs. But and Laura, I'd like you to speak a bit about in terms of policy and what is happening to our countries. I mean, the one issue, as pointed out by many people now, the most recently Friday night on the Bill Maher show, when
David Simon,
thank you, David Simon from The Wire, pointed out that nobody has brought up the issue of these drug wars in this campaign. But it is a critical issue policy-wise, and please address the kind of work you've been thinking and talking about.
Yeah, it has been shocking that with all the money that's going into the drug wars and this new policy of militarization under the drug wars, it's been such a non-issue in the campaigns. Of course, foreign policy has always kind of takes short shrift in political campaigns. But when you do look at the political platforms of both the Republican and the Democratic parties, they've got this same language of war. They're still talking about going into other countries. They're still talking about funding their militaries and their police in order to have them go out and fight a drug war that they know that they are never going to win, because we have enough history with this that it's never made any progress in any part of the country or under any circumstances in which it's ever been tried. So here we have this absolutely demonstrably failed policy that is not only repeated, but it's being expanded. We have the Merida Initiative in Mexico. Now we have the Central American Regional Initiative. They're talking about expanding into Caribbean and now even into African countries. So you have to wonder what's going on. Why would somebody expand a policy that's so obviously counterproductive? And that's when we begin to see that there's a lot of vested interest in this drug war. There's economic interest of the defense companies, the intelligence equipment, the security companies like Blackwater. And then there's political interest, particularly within the Pentagon, to increase its influence in many of these other countries. So right now I'm at the AFL-CIO, for example, where we just finished an event in which Javier Cecilia spoke and other members of the caravan and the AFL-CIO leadership. And now they've had a position for a long time against the Merida Initiative and against the drug war for basically two reasons. First of all, the United States government, under the pretext of the war on drugs, is funding the Mexican military. And the Mexican military is not only corrupt, as we know, which is a big problem in the drug war, but has been used to repress workers' movements in a very blatant way. And then the other thing is that they are also convinced, as is the largest coalition of unions, that the drug war is a failure, it's a waste of money, and it's taking away from the kind of social programs and labor programs and job programs that their members so desperately need now. So these are all the kinds of cross-border ties that we're seeing, and they're becoming even more obvious as people meet each other face-to-face in the course of this event.
And you know, just let me turn really fast so to get everybody's voice in here before we play this clip and really jump in to get our listeners here at 410-319-8888 to hear your solutions and ideas about what we do about the drug wars in our cities and our communities and around the country and around the world. But Billy Stanfield, I mean, you spent time in federal prison.
Yes.
As a drug dealer.
Yes.
And now you're in a different world.
Of course.
So your thoughts on what you're hearing about what our guests are saying in your own world. And what drew you from the world of the life of selling that kind of, selling drugs, I was about to say selling death, but that as well, selling drugs to what you're doing now.
Well, what everybody is talking about, those of us who have spent time in federal prison, we already knew. I'm going to talk about Unicorn in prison industry. A few years back, it came on 60 Minutes where the private sector was complaining that federal prisons could underbid them because they had slave labor. So each federal prison has a specialty. Some of them operate similar to UPS warehouses. It's called Unicorn. Some of them have telemarketing. Some of them make clothes, fix computers. And in prison, you can make $700-$800 a month working Unicorn. And so in federal prison, I realized that it wasn't about the Constitution. It seemed to be more about my body being used as slave labor to fit someone else's agenda. And because they blinded us with this war on drugs, they was able to push this agenda without the public really understanding what was going on, because we want our community safe. And so being in that position and just observing, and because keep in mind, you know, I'm a graduate of Cardinal Gibbons High School, so I wasn't a dummy. So I understood what was going on, and I knew that wasn't a life for me. So upon leaving prison, I dedicated my life to help as many young people as I could to not fall victim to what Sister Alexander says, this caste system. When you understand Jim Crow, that was legalized discrimination, and in many ways, our prison system represents that today. Because once a person is caught up in it, and the majority of the people being caught up in it is African-American and Latinos, we pretty much no longer have a life. Can't vote, hard to get a place to live, can't get a job. And then for me, I had family structure, you know, so but most people coming home may not have that kind of family structure. And then they go into a community that's under-resourced, no jobs, no job training, failing schools. So it's almost like there's been, created a certain socioeconomic status that almost kind of puts people in a place that they almost like survival of the fittest. And so we really got to take a good look at this holistically. Not only do we need to end the war on drugs, we have to look at the other underlying issues that is causing poverty in our community, because if we do need to end the war on drugs, we do need to make it a public health issue. But in doing that, we have to look at the other issues that are causing dysfunctionality too, or the crime and violence, but just move to another area.
So, and we haven't heard, we should hear now from Clayton Kahn, and why you, what, your role in this, what you learned, what you've learned. Because your pictures coming out of Mexico are powerfully poignant. They'll be up on our website, by the way.
So, for me, so I've spent a lot of time over the past 3 years in Mexico, and I've spent a lot of time living within that country. I went there to learn Spanish originally. I mean, the things that I've learned is that you see a lot of parallels between Baltimore and Mexico, and a lot of cities in Mexico. Over the past 6 years, you've seen massive devastation because of this war on drugs that in Mexico, the president, Felipe Calderón, declared that needed to end in terms of the cartels.
President of Mexico.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you see a lot of parallels. You see what a lot of people on this caravan are saying is sort of the disintegration of the social fabric. And that is occurring here in Baltimore. Just 3 days ago, we had people from the caravan come through and come to a park in West Baltimore and speak to a woman named Kimberly Armstrong who lost her son in this city due to drug war violence. And the same stories that are coming out of Mexico are the same stories that are coming out of Baltimore.
410-319-8888. I want you to join us here. We're gonna leap into the subject together about what is it we do then. So what's the alternative? To imprisonment, to the drug wars, whether it's wars by the police on and the judicial system on people in this country, whether it's drug wars that are killing people within the community, the drug wars between our countries, the money laundering taking place with the banks with Mexican drug money, are putting guns into Mexico that fuel that war, that fuels our drug habit. What do we do to unravel it all? You want to jump in here, Dr.
No, McGrath? I think we can go to the interview if it's ready. I mean, I think that the broader question mark that you asked, and I was going to ask Billy before you asked him a question, I was going to ask him why after 40 years and after the experiences that he's had, that law enforcement's had, we've had this broad conversation with judges and prosecutors about sentencing, and we know the disparities that exist in our criminal justice system. The other day I was so disturbed. I read something online that Thurgood Marshall III, the son of the great jurist from our city, sits on the board of several prison corporations and lectures around the country for them. And that name resonates with people who understand justice. And after 40 years of this war and then recently this dialogue, why is it that there's still – and maybe Laura knows the answer to this and certainly Neil and others who've been involved – why there still is so much taboo and stigma attached to this war on drugs, our consumption and addiction to drugs in this country, and how we prosecute and how we legislate this so-called war on drugs. You can't really talk about it unless you're in circles of like mind, because when you start talking about alternative sentencing, when you start talking about prosecution, and you're shut down. Or you're called a fringe element, or and that's why they're not. That's why President Obama's not talking about it. That's why Mitt Romney's not talking about it. But we know the devastation in the streets of our city, and we know the devastation in Mexico. It is frightening to me that it is such a still, Mark, and maybe I'm the only one who believes it or sees it. You can't really talk about this issue without people beginning to shut you down, and they use the most simplest of arguments. You're not tough on crime, and you know you got to be tough on these addicts to get them to come. It's sad to me, and it's frightening, because all we're going to continue to see in urban centers like Baltimore is the continued death and destruction of our families.
So the question I have for people on this panel is what do we do? I mean, what is society's response? What is the government response? What should we do? What has to change to make something different?
Let me tell you you said the government's response. Let me tell you what their responsibility is. Their responsibility is that when you have policy that is obviously broken, dysfunctional, not just failed, but cancerous upon our society, it is their responsibility to at least come to the table, bring the right people to the table, and figure out a new course of direction for this sunken ship that we're on. That's what they're and we can't even get them to do that.
Who's the them we can't get to do that, you're saying?
Name it. I don't care if you're talking about our state of Maryland to form the proper panel to say, you know what, the government, our federal government may not want to go in this direction, but you know what, we are, because we are concerned about all of our citizens. But then again, the federal government, they should be forming the proper panel. Look, Senator Jim Webb from Virginia has been trying to get a bill passed, legislation passed, just to convene a blue ribbon panel to dissect our criminal justice system, which includes our drug policy. He can't even get that through. And we all know, every single one of your listeners and beyond know, that our criminal justice system is completely dysfunctional at all levels.
And Jim Webb is leaving the Senate.
He said he's done.
Out of frustration. He is leaving the United States Senate.
I'm not surprised.
So, Laura, I mean, let me ask you to jump in here. I mean, let's talk about some – everybody can jump in on this. We have callers calling in. Susan and Julia, we're going to get to your calls as well. Talk about what do we need to do? What does legalization mean? How would that change anything? What would it change, I should say? Laura?
Well – Yeah, I'm here. Legalization, what it basically means in terms of other countries, is that it cuts off the lifeline of the drug cartels. I mean, we know that we cannot defeat the drug cartels by confronting them head on with violence. In the Department of Violence, they're always going to trump us. And so if you go after their income, they begin to be less able to buy arms, less able to recruit young people, less able to function, and far less powerful. So legalization, what it does is it takes this market out of their hands. When you have a black market, it's automatically controlled by criminals. The profits are automatically made by criminals. And if you legalize that, if you regulate it, then they no longer have control of that market. So that's why I began in doing this work a long, long time ago. And I was a little afraid for those same taboos that were spoken of before, to mention legalization as a possible solution. And now I just can't even see talking about this problem without talking about legalization, because it's really key. There has to be other things that happen as well, but it's really key to solving this problem. I just don't see any other way.
You're about to say something.
I was just going to say another aspect,
Clayton,
I think,
Khan,
that needs to be considered in terms of the public discourse, is breaking that stigmatization of the people who are mostly incarcerated, the people who are most directly affected. And this is part of the sort of the voices of the victims of this caravan are trying to bring that to light by saying, in terms of the social fabric that needs to be brought together, we need to break that stigma. The mainstream press in Mexico, for example, always highlights the fact that there are so many murders and they're done in so many gruesome ways because of the drug war, because of these cartels. But they never really give the stories and the faces to those murders. They put a lot of numbers out there. And it's the same here in Baltimore. You open up the newspaper and you'll see, you know, three dead last night in West Baltimore. But you don't really get the full story. You don't really get the faces, and you don't really elevate these stories of these victims, and you don't really find out who they actually are. And that's one of the big campaigns that they're really trying to push in this caravan. They're trying to let those who are most directly affected to speak and to say that, actually, no, my son was not involved in any kind of criminal activity. They were just out in the street, and they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So,
but that little girl who was shot and killed here in Baltimore just last week, who was an honor student, who was just killed because she was stuck in the middle of gunfire. Before we go to break, go ahead, Bill.
I wanted to say that, you know, power concedes nothing. Power concedes nothing without demand. When we look back over history, from slavery, Jim Crow, civil rights, we had to galvanize the community. We had to face that head on so that the world could see its ugliness. Right now, when we don't bring about enough community awareness, I just don't think we are strategic enough at educating our community on how this has failed and how it's negatively impacting our communities. And we really need to be more aggressive in doing that so that we can get people to wake up, where we can begin to put the proper amount of pressure on our politicians to fight for change in these unjust laws and procedures.
We'll take a very quick break. We're going to return to our guests, and also we're going to hear the voice of Javier Cecilia when we come back and go to our phone calls here. Susan Hank is calling in. We'll hear what he has to say. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
On our way back to the conversation, I have to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Music Jam 2012 with Peter Humphrey and the Oasis Band, Blackbird, Bobby's Music Machine, and Tony Carr. MC Music Jam 2012 is at the Panyard, 4559 Rhode Island Avenue, North Brentwood, Maryland, Saturday, September 29th. Doors open at 9. For more information, 301-847-6611. Excuse me. I want to have someone else being called for tickets, and they're not the right place. Sorry, you have the wrong number. But before we jump here back, let me hear. This is the first clip we want to play of Javier Cecilia, the man, the poet of Mexico, whose son was murdered. I asked him, as a father, what happened when his son was killed, and why he responded in the way he did.
As a father, I mean, I can only imagine the pain that you have gone through. But as a poet and as a thinker about our society, this tragedy moved you to do something beyond just mourning. Could you talk to us about that, about what moved you in the way you were moved to do what you do?
It was the love to my son that moved me there, because you can't, with this the size of this tragedy, which is not only his tragedy, but the tragedy happening in Mexico, you can't stay and do nothing before the size of these things, no? But basically, it was what happened to my son.
But the movement you began, you know, you were described in some articles as saying you're not a member of a political party. Maybe the closest thing you might be is an anarchist, not part of a political party.
See? Yes, I have always been an anarchist. I think, based on the Gospels, that anybody who is a Christian based on the Gospels has to be an anarchist. And yes, I do not believe the parties are doing what they should, But also, I think the government, although I'm an anarchist, the government has to do its duty, has to do what they are for, no? What they are there for, what they were elected there for. And basically, that's what we've been asking, that the government does what they have to do.
So before we go back to some more clips from our conversation, I want to say, what does the government have to do? Let's pick up on that point. So I asked the gentlemen in the studio and now Laura Carlson by phone as well. So let's wrestle with what do you do? If you are in not just pushing the government but are inside of it, you're asking city council, state legislatures, the U.S. Congress, the White House, what do you want them to do? What does it mean to legalize drugs? What does it mean to legalize marijuana? What does it mean to legalize cocaine and heroin or decriminalize it? So, you know, to take that out of the drug war, start with that. What does that mean for us? How do we do it?
Well,
what's it look like?
The first step is very easy. It's a very easy one. Marijuana. It's currently a Schedule I drug. That means it has no medicinal value and it's highly addictive. That's crap. First of all, you remove marijuana from Schedule I. In doing so, if you put it down to a 3 or 4, you can allow the states to decide what they want to do with the regulation and control of marijuana. And personally, I don't use. I recommend that no one use any drug, including alcohol. However, it allows the states to regulate it similar to alcohol. And that's a model that already exists. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. And we stand a better chance of keeping it away from our kids. As you move into other drugs, such as heroin, for those who are addicted, you know what? Yeah, you might have to give it to them under maybe a prescription program, maybe under Obama's new Obamacare program. But what that will do immediately is they no longer have to break in your car or your home or lie to their family members. They can then live a reasonably normal life other than, you know, needing their drug to support their habit. Why is it that we treat someone who's addicted to heroin different than someone who's addicted to alcohol?
Right.
So, you know, and that's just an example with two drugs right away. But so we just need to figure that out. And I just want to, I'll end with this, my piece, and let others chime in.
Sure.
If we start moving down this road, these are my top 10, because people need to see and get a visual image of what their communities would begin to look like if we move down this road. And I've given this a lot of thought and a lot of time. Number one, we know that crime and violence would drastically be reduced. From the dealers on the street corners no longer fighting each other to those addicted, breaking into homes and robbing people and so on. So we know that that would happen. Mexico's a whole other story. We'd save tens of thousands of lives. To reduce disease, AIDS, and hepatitis C, like in Portugal, where it's been reduced by 75% for intravenous drug users. To reduce addiction, to reduce overdose deaths, again in Portugal, a 52% reduction just through decriminalization. Corruption would be reduced, police and our public officials. We would be able to refocus our police priorities to crimes of violence instead of clearing corners every time you turn around and locking up people for nonviolent drug offenses. We would improve police relations big time. We would defund criminals and criminal enterprises to the tune of $322 billion globally a year. We would save our economy well over $1 trillion that we spent in the last 4 decades. And we would restrict access to drugs by our kids dramatically. Dramatically. And then I added number 11, and that's the prison industrial complex.
Which is
the
huge.
Thousands of people that we would save, mainly black and Latino, from going into prison and being subjected to a new form of slavery.
So, Laura Carlson, I know you have to leave in a few minutes, so let me let you take the rest of that. So, as a policy person, so what would this change mean? How would you do it?
From the foreign policy perspective, you know, there's already from Latin American presidents and ex-presidents a lot of suggestions on the table, and they demand that the debate on legalization be opened up by saying that these prohibition policies have absolutely failed for their countries as well. So what happens if we legalize? What do we need to change? First of all the things that were just mentioned. And secondly, in our countries, in the countries south of the border, in Mexico and Colombia and others, They save a tremendous amount of their budget that they need because they're desperately poor people in their country. They are battling to get to a U.S. market. If there's no longer a U.S. market for illegal drugs, then those battles cease to have meaning. And we find also, I'm convinced that we would find a dramatic reduction, an almost immediate reduction in the amount of violence that's led to these 60,000 deaths here in Mexico in just the past 5 years. We need to ask Congress to stop funding the drug war through the Merida Initiative others, and turn that foreign policy aid with money that's so scarce these days in our budget to productive building of communities that make them more able to resist the temptations of organized crime for their young people, to offer their young people other options, to create strong communities so they can control the infiltration of crime in their streets. All these would be changes that could happen relatively quickly, except for there's such a block and there's so many myths that still surround this issue. But we've been seeing a lot of changes, including those reports by ex-presidents and presidents calling for it. They're seeing a lot of changes coming from the South American countries, and there's hope that eventually this message will come out and create change in the United States as well, and that's really where we could really begin to change the whole global situation.
So let me do this. I need to go to listeners, and a lot of those guests come in as well, because they have people calling in with their thoughts and ideas. Let's go to Susan, and then Hank and Clarence, in that order. Susan, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark. My full name is Susan Gastaniaga. You might remember I had the pleasure of being on your show in May of 2010.
Yes, yes.
When I was running for governor. Anyway, I'll try to make it brief. People are talking about what do we do next as citizens. I suggest that first we want to raise our voices and demand that candidates who are now opposed to the war on drugs be included in any debate. We know that the Libertarian and Green candidates for U.S. president are against the war on drugs. They should be in all the debates, especially the ones on television. I'm right now the campaign manager for the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, Dean Ahmad, trying to work out to make sure that he's included in any debates between okay. Democrat and Republican. And the same goes for candidates at the for U.S. Congress. There are Greens and Libertarians who are running in Maryland for those offices, and they are, as we know, all opposed to the war on drugs. And, of course, then vote for them.
Okay.
Thank you, Susan. I'm glad you joined. Did you want to jump in, Anthony?
Well, I just think that I'm fascinated by the conversations and the reasonable and rational conversations that people like Major Franklin and others who have been involved in law enforcement, but also former presidents, former diplomats who have watched this war on the front lines and watched the impact on countries and no less than our own country. But I wonder what, and I'll ask Billy this, and I know we'll go back to the phones, what is the moral price we pay when we talk about, because I don't think you could find a family in Baltimore who has not been touched by addiction. I mean, I just don't think you could.
Whether it's alcohol or
some other drug, unless they lie, that someone in their family has struggled. But yet, you and I both know as ministers that when we have these conversations, when we talk about the reality of it, that many times people retreat to a certain denial. And they say, well, if you talk legalization, even if you talk medicalization, even if you talk alternative sentencing, that there's a certain amount of giving up. Not conquering the problem, but giving in to the problem. And they will push back on us. They don't even allow us to expand the conversation that we have to have if we're going to say black families, Latino families, all families. You got to have that conversation. But there is this taboo and, well, what you're doing is you're giving in. You're giving up on addiction and giving up on the drug trade. You're giving up on people.
No, I don't think that's the case. You're absolutely right. In Christendom or in the religious community, we do face this because sometimes we do live in that taboo mindset. But the reality of it is that the way that we have been approaching this as a community has not been working. Mm. This way, it'll make it easier for people to come out, easier for people to reach out for help, and it'll better position us to help people. We as we say from the Bible, we all were born in sin and shaped in iniquity. So my struggle may not be yours, but your struggle is your struggle. And I think that this would better position us to help those who are struggling instead of us putting those, you know, faces on, as mm-hmm. we call those church faces, and coming up with creation statements. But we know we're struggling with something. So this takes the stigma out of it in many ways if we can begin to approach this head on. It allows people to come clean with themselves.
Well, I mean, what is the problem? The problem is apparently drug abuse. Mm-hmm. Not drug use, drug abuse. You can't legislate morality. It's a bad solution that we have chosen. What we're talking about here is a solution. The solution doesn't work. We now have to come up with a new solution. And that new solution, which really isn't a new solution, we know that treatment and education work so much better than criminalization. It's also a lot cheaper. So what we're talking about is shifting our solution, shifting our resources for that solution into health and focus on it from that perspective. Cigarettes are legal. But what have we done with the use of tobacco products over the past couple of decades? Decrease has almost been cut in half. We sent no one to prison. We've murdered no one. All we did were a couple of things. We taxed it, and we made it uncomfortable for you to smoke around other people.
Banned billboards.
That's right.
Yeah, banned billboards, advertising. It's being smart about how you reduce use of something. You don't prohibit it, because if we prohibit tobacco products, watch out, folks. And no matter how many people die from alcohol, more people die from alcohol than anything else out here.
Anything.
Do we want to go back to the 1920s and 1930s? I think not.
And I was one of those people who grew up in a home, and let's go back to the phones here, then go back to the to Clarence, to Clayton, is that, you know, I grew up in a home where with a brilliant, sensitive, creative mother who I loved to death, who was an alcoholic. And we suffered through that, as many families suffer through people who have addiction. You know, but what people do is you wrap your hands around the people you love and you help them figure out how to get out of their addiction,
which she did before she died, which
was wonderful for her and for us. So, I mean, those things are real. And we all, no, as you said, Anthony, that's why I said that, because no family is untouched. Clarence, I'm going to, Hank, you're on the air, and then go to Clarence. Hank, you're on the air.
How are you doing today, Mr. Stein?
Very well. Welcome.
How are you doing, Mr. McCarthy?
Hey, Hank. Great to hear from you.
I'm blessed. First of all, let's look at this realistically, right? We already got legal drugs in America. We got Oxycontin, Dukes, all of these other drugs which are given out at the local dispensary for people who are addicts who want to get off of. So we got the legalized drugs to get them, but they're already passing them. Oh, right? Why would they want to give up all the money that they're making off of incarcerating us and off of, I mean, just think about this. If they legalized drugs, you'd have half of the correctional force without jobs, half of the police force without jobs, right? All of the free labor that they get from building furniture and stuff, that the government makes the other state facilities, such as colleges and schools, stop from the jail. Why would they get rid of that? That's money that they're making off of. They ain't ever going to get rid of. They'll never legalize it. Even a Schedule I drug would take off a good 40-60% of the young black men who feel as though they have a problem because they father left them and they want to smoke a bag of weed. They couldn't lock that man up no more. So why would they legalize that? This is a circle that keeps us. If we don't want it, we got to step away from it. Plain and simple. Right? They ain't ever going to give us anything. We got to take what we want. Stand up for what you believe in.
Hank's always great to hear from you, Billy. And I know, let's go to Billy and Clayton. Billy and then Clayton.
I appreciate the last caller's passion, but they didn't want to end slavery. They didn't want to end segregation. The issue is, as I said earlier, power can seize nothing without the man. He's absolutely correct. There's billions of dollars being made by an elite group of people off this prison system. And we have to begin to push back more public awareness, more rallying behind this. We have to face this issue head on, or it won't end.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is sort of shift the conversation a little bit in terms of thinking of what people have already mentioned, which is the strong communities. How do we build strong communities? Baltimore is devastated. A lot of the communities are fragmented. And what I've learned through my experiences in Mexico is that they've had a history of very strong communities, and that's what's enabled a lot of these people to be on this caravan, for example, to be very organized. And that's why they talk a lot about the destruction of the social fabric. And if we look here in Baltimore, we see that a lot of communities are fragmented. We can look at the economic reasons. We can see a city that has changed dramatically in the past 30 years due to major economic policies that has shifted from an industrial-based economy to service-based. So you look at folks and you look at why they're turning to perhaps addiction and drug abuse, and you look at why there's broken families, and you can see that you know, if you're in a service-based economy, if you're making $7 an hour or whatever, you're not going to be able to have a future. And so there's a lot of I think looking at the economic standpoint is really important into this whole discussion, and looking at what people are doing locally here, for example, in Baltimore on the ground to challenge those things. So what are different groups doing in this city that are looking at strengthening their communities in a real way, in sort of a grassroots level way? And you look at people who are challenging sort of the larger economic model within this city that has shifted a lot over the past 30 years and are looking to develop new, more local models in ways that create healthier communities in general so that young people are not turned to drug addiction.
And Mark, I contend that, although I appreciate Hank's analogies, that we would not see, and I think there is obviously a vested interest by a lot of those parties he pointed out, but our police department's priorities would change. We wouldn't necessarily see a 40% loss of police officers, but what we would see is a real change of policing strategy and what their priorities are. And the same thing for government. I think if we had a few courageous leaders, and I'm not just talking about here in the city. I criticize them enough here in the city. I'm talking about courageous leaders in our neighborhoods, in our communities, as well as in public office, who would say, I'm not going to stop having this conversation, no matter how uncomfortable it gets. You know, but we're going to have to push this because we are losing this war on drugs. And I'm not going to allow another $1 trillion to be wasted over another 40 years, dollars that could go into changing those communities that Clayton just told us about. But unfortunately, Mark, that vested interest that so many have will never allow us, I say, and this is very cynical, to reach that tipping point we were talking about in the break, where we finally say, no, we are going to change the culture of our community to save our community, and that we're going to be grown-ups. We're going to sick of losing our children. We're sick of losing our husbands and our wives, sick of losing neighborhoods to decay and crime. And we're going to take control, and we're going to force this conversation on legalization, medicalization, whatever the conversation is, as well as the prison industrial complex. But there's no ball. I mean, there's no courage. I forgot where I was for a moment.
You had it right the first time.
But there's no courage to force all of us to own this, to really own what's going on around us.
Yeah. Before we get too deep into this, I want to go to the phones again, but I want you to hear just another short clip. And we're going to play the entire interview for you in a few days with Javier Cecilia. When I asked him about to quantify the impact of the war on drugs that it's had on Mexico, and here's his response.
Because we have, was it, how many people have been killed? 40,000? How many missing? How many?
This is one of the main problems. They haven't even contabilized. They disappeared. They don't have the numbers, and if they do, they're not giving the numbers. We are talking very conservatively, us, of 70,000 killed, 20,000 disappeared, and about 250,000 that had to leave their homes. Desplazados.
The displaced ones.
Wow. Talk about courage, Anthony. I was at the beginning when they crossed the border, the caravan, my Mexican family crossed the border from Tijuana into San Diego. And I went with them for a couple of cities. And then I joined back up with them in Houston to Atlanta and now in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And I've listened to their stories, each and every one of their stories. And talk about courage. Some of them have received threats on their lives for the work that they are doing. But yet they do it anyway because they know how important it is to change these policies. and they know that they have to go back home. They know that their family members are at risk, their children, but yet they still speak out. I would love it if our policymakers would have one-tenth of the courage that these men and women have. They are a shining example of how we should be approaching this and what we should be doing. And I really wish that more of our policymakers would be attending these events. And they still have time in Washington, D.C. to attend these events for the next 3 days in Washington, D.C. You know, that's all I have to say.
And I would just add real quickly, very fast, and I wish our media had the courage to tell those stories. Mark, you're one of the few.
You are one of the few
is willing to talk about this and share this story. And I know this because I've been involved in the marketing and the media of this group coming through our city and begging the mainstream press to cover this story. You know, if they could have seen those 120 people in that caravan come into this city, come into Baltimore— if those images could have been broadcast on television and, like, you've told this story and forced the conversation on the policy, it's almost shameful that we'd rather talk about a cat in a tree than talk about families in Mexico and in Baltimore that are impacted by this war on drugs.
And I would encourage people to go to our website and see Clayton's pictures that'll be up there that captures the faces of the brave men and women from Mexico and in Baltimore
who
are standing up for a change.
And you know, there's still a quick opportunity for courage here in Baltimore City because now until we change this policy, the work still needs to be done to save our people. There's a racial profiling piece of legislation that was brought about by two citizens here in the city, Brother Owens Bay and Mr. Sonny Jones, and it has had one hearing in City Hall, and it's been postponed, so it's got to come up for some more. You know, call your city council person, find out about that piece of legislation for racial profiling, and make them have additional hearings on that. I mean, we're locking our people up in the city left and right, violating their rights, and something needs to be done about it.
Owens Bay and Sonny?
Sonny Jones.
Sonny Jones. I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll make sure they come on the air here and we'll bring some city council people along with those two men and have the conversation. How's that? That's what we need to do. And do we have time for the caller? Yes, no? May I? My producer says I may. Clarence, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Steiner.
Hey, Clarence.
First of all, you know, Wall Street has a vested interest legally through in the prison industrial complex. You know, there's a bottom line there for them. So your guest is suggesting that we can't take the drug money, the money out of the cartel's hand because we have an inability to regulate what's going on in the financial institutions in this country. That's a problem with the government. Also, it seems to me that we've lost the silliness and decency in our society when, if you look at it from the middle of it, okay, I'm off drugs now. I'm still sitting here. I have no job. I can't feed myself. I can't support my family, and all of the other things that a human being would do. On the bottom end of it, people of conscience stand up for these things, and black politicians, seemingly, I could say that, have not stood up in the last 40 years. That's why we listen to you, Mr. Steiner, because a show of conscience is directed by a person of conscience. Quickly, I used to watch in the 80s down in Atlanta when I was hanging cable. I watched Hosea Williams in places like Bankhead Courts and Herndon Homes and some of the other housing projects down there. And he would knock on door to door in front of the drug dealers and tell young ladies with children, this is what you have to keep your kids away from, the prison industrial complex. It was the most courageous thing I'd ever seen in my lifetime. And he would do it in front of the drug dealers. So you have to, instead of legalizing drugs, why don't we start at the top and the bottom? Get the ones off of drugs there and the ones that are coming up. Because most of the young people out here selling drugs in the corner now will tell you, if I had another alternative, I wouldn't be doing this, Unc.
Clarence, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time here for this segment, but I appreciate you being part of the show, as always, and calling in. I want to thank our guest for this hour in the studio, Clayton Kahn. Please go to our website and see the work he's doing, shooting the work he's done. Retired Major Neil Franklin, for being out there, both intellectually, emotionally, and with his soul, for out there to fight for this change after his years as a police officer. And Billy Stanfield, who's been through a lot, to become a minister and keep fighting. Good to have you. Always a pleasure to have you on the studio,
Billy. Thank you. Good to be here, too.
and our other two guests who had to leave a little early, Laura Carlson, who's working with Latin American Rights and Security, the Center for International Policy, and earlier Jorge Gonzalez de Leon, who was part of the caravan and risking his life as a Mexican to stand up against the drug lords.
And thank you, Mark Steiner. I mean, we don't say it nearly enough. Not only are you a man of courage, but you still have faith that human beings, humanity, can in fact save itself. And so thank you for allowing us to have this conversation.
Thank you, brother, for saying that. So we'll be more of this, and we'll bring those brothers on you talked about in the next week to get talk for our city council people about racial profiling.
That would be great. Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that in the next hour, Anthony and I will, with
we
our
are.
Guest, which is about this racial profiling and what that does and the subtlety, the implicitness of racism in our society and what it's doing to us and how we can address it. So that's our next hour. Stay with us. And, gentlemen, thank you all for being with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Thank you.